You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. On this week's show, continuing our month of shows looking at unusual depictions of superheroes, I'm talking to American artist J.H. Williams III, whose excellent body of work combines elements of graphic design and fine art to produce some of the most stylish comics published by DC over the last decade, including Chase, Batwoman, and Alan Moore's Promethea. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
Talking to J.H. Williams, Jim to his friend.
Yes.
You first broke into comics 16 years ago, right, drawing various titles for Milestone.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? Were they a DC imprint that were looking for new artists, or was it just a coincidence that you'd submitted art and it was a fairly relatively new imprint?
It was kind of a weird situation, because I had been doing the whole, you know, portfolio circuit where you show your stuff to editors, you know, time and time again. And I was always getting interesting feedback. I was like, oh, well, you know, we're really looking for some, you know, this kind of look and or this kind of style or whatever. And I would do that and come back the next year, and then that's no longer what they were interested in. And I did that for a few years, and it was kind of grueling and kind of disillusioning in a way. And I actually, my wife is the one who convinced me. She's like, just draw the way you want to draw. Don't worry about what they say, and just kind of take what you think they're telling you works for you and what doesn't. So yeah. I ended up doing that, and then ended up very quickly doing some independent work. One of the things got published and one of the things didn't, but they were basically two completed comics that were independent but both very different in style. One was very like bad urban vigilanteism sort of stuff, and another one was a very adult science fiction sort of thing. And that's the one that didn't get published. Well,
was that the one that was in Metal Hurlant?
No, that this was something. Do you remember the creator Chuck Austin?
Worked on Miracle Man.
Yeah, and then went on and did some writing for a while for DC and Marvel, but he mainly went into being like art director for animation and things like that. Well, this was a project that he had done, and the way that came about was he was the writer and artist of a very adult strip called Strips, and it was very funny, very good stuff for the content, and he was having trouble being able to continue it. So he was asking me to kind of take over the art duties, and so I was working in a more of a cartoony style because it was a very cartoonish book. Which taught me a lot of interesting lessons, and I was able to apply that to more realistic drawing. And then I showed him my realistic drawing stuff, and he really, really liked it, and it had this science fiction concept, adult material. And so that's how I ended up doing that. And I drew like 40 pages of it, and then while doing that, I also was working on this vigilante thing. Well, the writer of the vigilante thing had gone to a convention in Oakland, California, WonderCon, before it moved to San Francisco. And I had, at that point, was kind of tired of just trying to show my stuff to editors, and decided, well, maybe I should show my stuff to creators I respect. Well, he was at the convention the day before I was arriving, and he took the samples of the gritty vigilante stuff and showed it to Howard Chaykin. And so when I arrived that evening, he's like, you have to go talk to Howard Chaykin. He really liked this. I'm like, really? Okay. But I had the other samples with me for the other book, too. So I managed to go over there the next day and talk to Howard. And, you know, I was told to come talk to you and this and that, and I said, I'd really like to get a critique from you, and I have these other samples that I'd like to show you besides the ones you've seen. And he's like, oh, you really don't want a critique from me, not a real critique, you know? Mm. And he's got a reputation for being, you know, a bit gruff and things like that, but he's...
Yeah, I know, I interviewed him.
Yeah. But, you know, when you break it down, he's really a sweetheart. That he's, you know, has this very rough exterior in a way. But I convinced him to give me a real critique. So it forced him to analyze the work in a different way where, you know, he was looking at the adult samples and the vigilante thing at the same time, but he went through page by page and was like, oh, you know, this is great. This is shit. This is great. This is shit. And he just went through the whole thing. But there's some things I was doing even then that had some unorthodox storytelling stuff that he didn't quite relate to. And so he asked me, he's like, I don't understand, you know, why are you doing this? This is weird. But I had an answer for him. It wasn't arbitrary. And so he saw that I was thinking. And by him slowing down and really looking at what I was doing, you know, he said, these are some of the best amateur samples I've seen in a long time. He says, why aren't you working? You should be working. And I said, I can't get anyone to pay attention. He's like, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He gets up from his table and walks me over to the DC booth. And you, since you've interviewed Howard, you know how bombastic he can be. So at the top of his lungs, he's telling people, give this man a job. Even if it means me writing something for him, give him a job. Now, of course, that made everyone go, what? Howard's talking loudly, but it's positive. And Dennis Cowan at the time, that's when the milestone thing was, you know, kicking in the gear and all that stuff. And he came up to me and gave me his business card, and we were talking a little bit. And then even after that, it took like 80 phone calls, I think, to get someone to call me back. Because there's so much, they get inundated with samples and people wanting stuff. And so, but by me being so diligent and calling like I did, it made it to when they actually needed someone to do a fill-in issue. I'm the guy they remembered because I've been leaving phone call after phone call on their message machine. They saw how serious I was about trying. They gave me a shot.
I wondered about that because you seemed to bounce about an awful lot doing an issue here and an issue there before you had a meaty run on anything.
Yeah, and that's pretty much... Yeah, it's kind of like this weird thing. They're like, oh, okay, this guy... We like what he does for the most part. He's still fresh and new, has a lot to learn, but let's give him a shot. And if you turn in the work on time and it's passable, they see that you can tell a story, then they go, okay, well, let's give him the next fill-in then, and so on and so forth. And that's how it kind of built that way.
But because you were only able to work on a title for a short period before moving on to the next one, did that make it difficult for you to feel that you'd become a recognisable artist in terms of a style that represented how you wanted to see yourself in print?
I think so. In some ways, it's definitely true. But, you know, at the time, I was just really excited just to be working. And, you know, even I look back at that material now, and it boggles my mind that they actually gave me a shot, because I honestly don't think this stuff was very good. But I think it was just that matter of diligence and sticking with it and getting the work done and craving to do more that made them give me more work. And the plus side to it, by being bounced around a little bit at first, was there was quite a few instances where essentially I kind of popped up out of nowhere doing several fill-in issues, but some of them were coming out at the same time. You know, so here's the milestone issue, but then here is this Green Lantern thing that I did, you know. Stuff like that. And so it was like, oh, simultaneous shelf life was kind of interesting. I think it got people to see my work somewhat rather quickly, you know. So that was good in that regard. I just wish the work was better and more memorable.
Obviously, you're known for superhero comics. Mm-hmm. You've drawn quite a few of them. But the side of your work that I think needs to be fed into the superhero titles that you work on are the more sort of mystical, the more kind of black ops things that occurred in, say, Chase, that occur in Promethea. did writers slowly become aware that if they skewed stories in those directions, you were the artist for the job rather than more traditional superhero stories?
Maybe. I've never really had those kinds of conversations with some of the writers I worked with back then. You know, at the time, you know, like I was saying, I was very excited just to be working, and I never really thought to either... I probably was more fear, you know, why are you picking me? but I do think that there's some truth to that statement in the regard of... there was lots of different things I was influenced by growing up with comics that I was able to apply to my work even back then. And so they could see that, yeah, I could do a superhero story, but then I could do something within the same context that's more grounded or more realistic or, you know, maybe a little noirish or things like that. And so that, and I think when writers can see the glimmer of versatility, it's attractive to them, because then they can go, oh, you know, I can throw this at him and he might get what I'm trying to say or do, you know?
Mm.
Yeah.
I think the first comic of yours that I came across that I thought, oh, I really like this artist and I want to follow him, was your run on Chase.
Oh, cool.
I was wondering how that came about, because in retrospect, it seems like maybe they were trying to tap into the X-Files popularity at the time and mix that with superheroes. Would that be a cheeky thing to suggest?
It's not cheeky at all. It's definitely a little bit of the angle that we were going for. Mm. But the way that came about was kind of a weird scenario in itself, because Eddie Braganza, who's still an editor at DC, he was one of the first guys I was doing fill-in issues for. Mm. He really liked what I was doing, and at the time, DC was doing one of their big events things, the Underworld Unleashed thing. And he had this one shot that he needed an artist for, which was the Hell Sentinel Abyss thing that had starred Alan Scott. And so I drew that. They really liked my interpretation because they wanted... that was kind of more of a mystical sort of bent for the character, and they saw I could kind of, you know, that I could gravitate to that and handle that pretty well. And at the time, they said that they were interested in pursuing a series with that character based on those more esoteric ideas and less superhero ideas.
Mm.
But I'm not quite sure how it came about, but they really didn't have, from what I understand, a real creative team set up for it. And so I just, out of the blue, out of my own, you know, naive ambition, said, you know, let us come up with a treatment for it, me and D. Curtis Johnson, who I created Chase with. And so we came up with a treatment. They really, really liked it and said, oh, but we want to do this. Then a couple weeks went by and they called us back and said, you know, look, things have changed. We really are not going to pursue this character in this way. We don't know what we're going to do with this character. But they liked the treatment enough. Mm. They saw the spark of imagination that we put into it enough that they said, you know, pitch us an idea. And so we're like, well, what do you like? And the editor, he's like, oh, I like chicks with capes, you know? Just almost a flippant sort of statement. And we're like, oh, what do we do with that? And
well, one day I'll do Batwoman, but until then.
and we ended up creating Chase, which was this detective trench coat. We thought, a trench coat could be kind of cape-like if drawn in certain ways. And we came up with this tough, kind of fierce female character. So in a sense, the creation of Chase was really just to get us a job.
Right.
You know, but we very quickly became closely attached to what we were doing and cared a lot about it. And I think it translated rather quickly, even though the series didn't, the sales weren't there. Nothing that DC was doing that year was selling very well in the series. But the material was good enough that it ended up having a really great shelf life amongst the fans after the fact.
But it was the title that never went away, because even though it was cancelled, it then kept on turning up as backup strips in all the sort of info
that's right.
comics.
That's right. And literally, I mean, 15 years later, I'd be at a convention or people were like, oh, we love Chase. We'd love to see more Chase. And it's one of those really interesting, weird things. And
well,
it's
the 100-page giant sells.
Exactly. It's kind of like, I think we were a little bit ahead of our time on it conceptually. But at the time we got canceled, it was a bit unfortunate because we had, at that point, it was around the 1 million issue because DC had the, Grant was doing the DC 1 million thing, event thing, and we had our 1 million issue. But at that point, they had decided to cancel the book, and we were, you know, kind of upset that, oh, our last issue is going to be the 1 million issue. It doesn't really say much other than it can kind of give people, if they really extrapolate and think really hard, where the themes are of where we were going. But there was a buzz happening at that time amongst the fans, sort of an underground sort of swell. But at that point, they've already made the decision. And I actually had drawn like maybe 7 to 10 pages of the next story, which was going to be a 4-part big Justice League thing. Which was going to have all of the, like, really, it was really going to get to the heart of the matter of everything we were building towards. I honestly feel like if we had gotten those 4 issues, it might have turned that around. That series might have survived. But the plus side is, you know, we did create a character that people like, and other writers seem to like the character and try to do things with the concepts and stuff like that. I think we're going to see more of that character in some forms, so.
And with Chase, because it was a comic that you actually got to develop over a number of issues rather than fill in here and there, was that the comic where you felt you were kind of honing your style as a recognisable artist? Because it seemed to be the place where you first started experimenting with unusual size panel borders and layouts and introducing graphic design into the comic in a way that a lot of other artists don't.
Yeah, I think what made that come about is like, it's like things that I always kind of like design in graphic presentation, there are like the germs of ideas just floating in the back of my subconscious. But since we were the writers on that, it opened up the door to go, oh, well, how can we get across certain kinds of information? Like one of my favorite things that we came up with for that was, on occasion we would have a page where, you know, it's maybe 3 or 4 panels, but it's broken by a strip, and that strip, all of a sudden the dialogue becomes script. And so it's more like, you know, character is saying this, and the next character responds, and so forth. And it created an interesting design. But what was interesting about it was like, ooh, look how much information we're able to get into that one page because of what we did with design. So I think being, you know, the fact that we were writing it ourselves and stuff really, you could say, oh, well, we can come at this from however we want, you know.
And then I think that the next project after that that sort of gave you a really long chunk of time to develop a character and maybe experiment with what you could do as an artist was Prometheus. Massive tone. From the beginning of that project, did Alan give you an idea of what it was going to involve? Because I think for people reading it at the start, they didn't realize the comic would then eventually be an epic tour through the history of magic and the iconography of, you know, of the way that magic is practiced.
Yeah, the first conversations I had with him on the phone was pretty much, he really didn't talk about the magic stuff with me right away, other than it was pretty much, he says, we're going to do a fantasy comic. But he says, I want to break the rules of what is expected of a fantasy story. And it's funny because a lot of the Wonder Woman kept getting associated with the concept of Promethea in terms of a relatable character that people might recognize in terms of, but that actually had never been brought up in our conversations. I don't think Alan ever really, as far as I know, saw her as an, you know, a Wonder Woman archetype. I think he saw her purely as a fantasy archetype.
But then I guess comics fans maybe don't have the broadest range of references when they look for similar things.
Yeah, they see, oh, tall, you know, Amazon-like figure, you know, with some Greek history and things like that. Yeah, they really gravitated to the Wonder Woman thing, and kind of didn't think about that there was also, wasn't just Greek history involved with the character, but there was a little bit of Roman and things like that in there too. But I think probably after, I don't know, the first issue, he started talking to me more about, you know, his more personal interests, such as magic and things like that. And so it quickly went that way. And you know, it was very obvious, like in the first issue when she first becomes Promethea, and you know, the way she defeats the villain in that first issue, you know, the pentagram that she forms out of energy and spouting about being the goddess of art and all these things. It was very you know, definitely right away it was a cue that we're going someplace that people aren't going to expect, you know.
I've spoken to other artists who've worked with Alan, and they've said that they were quite invigorated by the challenge of working with Alan, particularly on the ABC titles, where often he would ask them to impersonate other artists for the sake of storytelling. I mean, there is, I don't know if you've got it here, but I saw an issue cover of Promethea where you have to do a pastiche of Van Gogh.
Yeah.
And I mean, were there many instances like that where he'd say, "I want you to do," and you'd think, "Oh my God, how on earth am I going to work that into my style?" You know.
The funny thing about that is actually a lot of that came from me.
Okay.
The conversations that I would have with him, because you know, of course, there's always historical references in the majority of his works. But in conversing with him, you know, I quickly, you know, wanted to meet him on an equal level as much as I possibly could, and said, "Oh, there's a lot, you know, I would like to try this and I'd like to try that." And I threw that at him, and of course Alan's like, "Oh yeah, we should totally do that. You're if you're game for that, let's go for it," you know. And same with the design aspect, you know, like the first issue of Promethea, I pretty much drew a lot of that without even telling Alan what I was going to do with some of the layouts. A couple of the layouts were very particularly his, but there was a lot of stuff where I interjected lots of things. And then when he saw that, we, you know, talked about it, and he was really fascinated that I was coming at it from a different perspective than typical comics of the time. And I think that made him write differently, because he started thinking of those things to put into the scripts as well.
Leading ultimately to the penultimate issue, where you actually have to disassemble the comic in order to read it in its entirety.
Yes. Yeah, that was that comic was, when he was telling me about it and describing it to me over the phone, it was pretty intimidating and kind of scary, and I was like, "Oh, I don't know," but it turned out to, even though it took a while for the issue to actually come out, it was the fastest piece of art I've done for the entire series, for some strange reason. But
the thinking of the crossover between graphic design, artistic influences, and your work, your short run on Batman for Grant Morrison, and your longer run illustrating Batwoman, they seem to be titles where the panel layout and the page layout seems to be very much dictated by things like Art Deco design, fractured psyches, you know, the iconic logos of things like the Bat Signal. When it comes to doing something like that, so that the design actually doesn't get in the way of the storytelling, it must be a bit of a tightrope in terms of producing the art.
It certainly is. And I'm sure there's, depending on which fan you talk to, some, you know, I see comments from some fans are like, "What is he doing? This makes no sense. This is crazy. It's hard to follow." But then there's other fans that can follow it very easily, which I find very interesting, because it shows how different each person's mind works and the way they interpret things. It's something I can't help but do. You know, and Promethea, in some ways, kind of unleashed a design monster in a way, because you know, we pretty much had carte blanche to approach things however we wanted to, and you know, I'm sure there's instances where we went too far, but it's worth the experimentation, particularly in terms of mainstream comics, because you just don't... There's so many artists out there. There's wonderful artists, don't get me wrong. I don't want to belittle anyone. But there's so many artists that kind of... A lot of comics today really are more like, oh, it's a storyboard, actually, for a film. And they've some of them have forgotten the aspect that comics... No, you're dealing with a page. You're dealing with still images and iconography at the same time.
And also a non-linear way of storytelling, which is
That's
something
right.
Alan is obviously very keen on. You know?
That's right. You can mess with time differently in a comic than you can any other way. You can take the graphic elements of the story and figure out what the basic iconography and symbolism is and use that as storytelling pieces. It almost harkens back to... I guess a primal sort of hieroglyphics sort of thinking, you know, and it's weird how many comics artists don't for a long time kind of have forgotten about that. And I think subliminally I was influenced by artists like Steranko and Jim Starlin and Will Eisner, and those guys were doing that well before I ever came along. And did it tremendously to just amazing, crazy ideas. And I remember seeing that stuff as a kid, and I think it really had a huge impact on me. And that in combination with when I was in school, I had 2 years of advertising art and design, and the teacher was more about, less about the quality of the drawings and more about the idea behind the drawing. What are you trying to say? And so those influences along with that teaching kind of made it to where I can't help but think in those terms. I can't help but think about the color and what the color means and the power that the color can have over the reader, the way something is drawn or a scene is drawn, or even a panel, taking one panel of a scene and isolating it and doing it differently can have the subliminal effect on the reader in emotional ways that they might not even realize is happening to them. I find that whole thing is very fascinating. You can't do that in anything but comics.
Which is presumably why it would make it difficult for you to work from very detailed scripts, because I guess a lot of your storytelling depends on the relationship of a panel to a page, to a splash page, to a monthly installment, to a graphic novel.
Yes.
So how much do you have to plan in advance, you know, in order for all those components to interlock?
Yeah, I have to understand where we're going. You know, there's a lot of comics today where the writing is good, it's fine, but sometimes you can see that the writer might not necessarily know what they're doing on issue 4 after this issue has come out. Or, you know, they're working very rapidly might not necessarily know exactly where they want to end up. Where for me, I really like to know where we're going to end up because it informs what I'm going to do now. But at the same time, I don't approach it too analytically and try to be as instinctual as possible, which is something Alan taught me right away. Because, you know, at first, when I first was working on Promethea, I had some trepidation about some, you know, hey, should I try this? So I'd call him, like, what do you think of this? He's like, yeah, fine, whatever you want to do, Jim, you know. he says, go for it. And he says, you know, he kind of taught me to really rely on my gut and do things on a more emotional level, which is really interesting to think about in terms of... you know, doing stuff so designed and thinking about, oh, well, if this is happening in this issue and I know that's happening in this issue, how can I make this relate to that where people aren't even going to realize until they've gone back and reread it or, you know, things like that, you know. It's all very instinctual in a way. You know?
I think it's interesting, actually, that Batman and Detective Comics are two titles where you can actually insert a run that almost subverts the longer... existence of the title. For example, you know, Frank Miller doing Year One as just a 4-issue run within that, you doing Batwoman in Detective Comics, Now even, you know, Jock taking over as the artist and detective, which seems very different to a lot of artists who have preceded him.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the two almost flagship titles of DC are ones that can be the most experimental.
Yeah, I think probably because maybe it has something to do with the longevity of them.
Mm.
You know, at some point, you have to be able to break the mold in order to gain something new. Otherwise, it becomes stagnation.
Mm.
And then it just becomes meandering and more of the same. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of fans out there that really like to just have that comfort zone.
Mm.
But, you know, as a reader myself, I like comics where they say, okay, we're going to take everything that you know and turn it upside down. Mm. You know, that's my favorite sort of thing, you know. I think the longevity of characters like Batman and Superman and so forth, I mean, where else can they go with it? It's either it ends, it dies,
after 72 years.
Yeah. And, you know, what Grant is doing on Batman in a lot of ways is pretty brilliant because he's kind of taking the entire history of Batman, even the stuff that for a long time they wanted to pretend didn't.
Mm. Well, Kathy Kane, for example.
Yeah. Stuff that just, you know, the weird stuff, like Batman fighting on a giant typewriter.
Mm.
You know, for a long time, DC wanted to kind of forget that sort of Batman existed, you know.
Mm.
And Grant's kind of like, no, it all happened. It's all the weird stuff is there, you know.
Mm.
I think that's brilliant.
And with the new Batman, with the new Batwoman ongoing title, you're writing it rather than drawing it.
Yeah.
So how much of a challenge are you setting the artists who are working with you in order to keep that kind of sense of innovation? And, I don't know, it's not experimental. That seems almost an insult because it's obvious you knew what you were doing, but experimental compared to other titles that DC are publishing.
It's kind of like my primary focus is just making sure it's a good story.
Mm.
Now, like the Zero issue that's coming out this month for Batwoman, we kind of came up with an idea that plays with form and time, and it's sort of two stories that are related to each other, but they happen at the same time on the page. But they take, like, okay, I'll kind of break it down very simply. The Batwoman sequence, which I draw.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Kate Kane sequence that Amy Reeder draws share space on the same page. But the Batwoman scene literally takes place over 12 minutes, roughly, where the Kate Kane scene takes place over maybe a month of time in the form of, you know, when you follow the narration, that's all becomes quite clear. But they all thematically line up when they need to on the right pages to where certain things click. So that in some ways that's, you know, being somewhat experimental, but, you know, we just want to make sure it's a good story and then figure out how, okay, this is a story we want to tell, we really like the story, now how do we make that different, you know, how do we approach it differently? Writing for Amy, I kind of just have to write the sort of script that I would like to get. Mm. One of the things I was trying to tell Alan yesterday when I got to see him was how much I learned from working with, you know, writers like him on the details of the scripts. So our scripts are rather thick because I want to get in all those atmospheric details and things that try to spark her imagination. You know, I don't know. It's hard for me to say how much I'm actually challenging her other than, you know, I'm trying to describe the visuals in terms of what I see in my head. You know, I can't see it any other way. And, you know, hopefully she seems really excited over it and really seems to like what's there. One of the things that we're doing that's a bit experimental from a writing side for her storyline is, listen, we go into an espionage sort of thing in her arc. But we decided we wanted kind of a James Bondian sort of plot, but how do you do that in comics and have it be fresh? Because a James Bond plot translated into comics can kind of be ho-hum until you get to the big moment at the end.
Yeah, well, particularly with Casanova still being serialized.
Yeah.
Which has set the bar.
Yeah, and so it kind of is like, how do you do that without... and keep the readers engaged until the big moments at the end. So what we've done is kind of like we're telling the James Bondian plot with a Quentin Tarantino format.
Mm.
So,
making up for the fact that Tarantino didn't get to make Casino Royale as he wanted.
So, you know, we kind of like, okay, we follow all these different characters, storylines, mm-hmm. leading up to the big moment, but it all starts, you know, in the past. So it's like, this character is 1 month ago, but then the next character is, you know, 3 days ago. But they're all, each issue is framed by the present, but you only get one piece of the present per issue, building up to the big whole. So that's kind of an experimental thing to do. It's a little bit non-linear in some ways, but yeah. At first we were kind of going to jump around a lot in time, but then we decided, no, we'll keep everything in the past building up to the present, but each character's point, their beginning point, starts at a different time from each other. Mm. And eventually they'll cross and meet up in different things. So like the villain will show up in pretty much each person's segment. And we're literally going to do things with the captions, like, you know, we're going to have Maggie Sawyer be a big part of Batwoman's life.
Mm.
So if it's her part of the story, it says Maggie's story.
Mm.
And in the next issue, it'll be Maggie's story.
Okay.
But, you know, maybe a week closer to now, you know, things like that. Yeah.
And with you writing more and drawing less of Batwoman, what can we expect from you next as an artist? Because I, for one, would like to see some more Desolation Jones.
Honestly, Batwoman is going to keep me very busy, okay. even from an art standpoint, because we have the Zero issue that I just finished. I finished drawing the art for issue one. The first arc for Batwoman takes roughly 5.5 issues, if you count the Zero issue. And then Amy will be working on the second arc, which will be from issues 6 to 11.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. 6 to 11. And while she's doing that, I'll be working on arc 3. So, yeah, that's going to be keeping me very busy. More Desolation Jones certainly would be fun. There's been... The publisher has called me a couple times, you know, saying that there might... be some interest in that, and you know, I said, well, you know, if the scripts are there, then we'll think, you know, we'll see what we can do. But I have to, you know, pretty much stay focused on what's right in front of me at the time. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Cool.
For more info about J.H. Williams III's comics, please visit our blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. And if you'd like to watch my interview with Jim, you can see a video podcast of our interview on Orbital Comics' website, www.orbitalcomics.com, where the interview was recorded and filmed, and I'd like to thank everyone at Orbital for their help and hospitality. The end of November brings the last two major comic book events of the year, Thought Bubble in Leeds, more of which later, and the third week of Comica, at various sites across London. These include Storytelling, The Future is Graphic, a free talk by Paul Gravett on new developments in comics, at the London College of Communication at the Elephant and Castle, London SE1 6SB, which is on November the 19th at 10 a.m, Louis Wayne, The Man Who Drew Cats, in which BBC and Channel 4 broadcaster and comedy writer David Quantick explores the life and work of the Edwardian cat artist with underground cartoonist Savage Pencil. That's at the London Print Studio, 425 Harrow Road, London W10, on November the 23rd from 7 p.m. Then on November the 24th, again at the London Print Studio, Thomas DeSantis, Carlos Nin, and Oscar Zarate are exploring the rich traditions and vital current scene of comics in Argentina, and that starts at 6:30 p.m. You can find more info about all the above and more at www.comicafestival.com. Thought Bubble begins on Thursday the 18th of November with a two-day conference on comic books. Thursday's theme is Women in Comics, and features talks by Susie Varty, who published the UK's first all-woman comic book, Heroine, in 1977, Maureen Burdock, creator of the F-Word Project, and the Danish comics group Pennevenidia, including artists Karen Hansen, Monica Hihuen Jensen, and Ricky Hollander. The theme of the conference on Friday the 19th is the ties between the production and the scholarship of comics, and includes talk on the work of Will Eisner, Scott McCloud, Chris Ware, and Daniel Close. Saturday the 20th of November sees a one-day comics convention take over the Royal Armouries and the Alia Casino in Leeds, and guests include Becky Cloonan, Kick-Ass artist John Romita Jr., and renowned Starman and ex-Mechana artist Tony Harris. Finally, on Sunday the 21st, London-based small press group We Are Words in Pictures join forces with the Manchester Comics Collective to host a day of art and writing workshops, as well as a free drop-in and draw session for people of all ages and abilities. Throughout the 4 days of the festival, there are additional talks, workshops, screenings and exhibitions around Leeds, and there's info about all the above on their website, www.thoughtbubblefestival.com. And panel boarders, we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.